Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm Paul Vogelsang, and this is episode number 216. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living interview series, we're joined today with Elizabeth Griffith. Historian Elizabeth Griffith, a biographer of suffrage pioneer Elizabeth Cady Stanton, leads a fast-paced series at the Smithsonian Associates that examines the history of women in America from the colonial period through second-wave feminism. Each session covers approximately a century of American history. The sessions are ongoing, and they trace the advances, setbacks, accomplishments, and complications of the nation's diverse women.
American women experience our history on two timelines, one blue, one pink. The blue traditional timeline marks accomplishments of male explorers, settlers, founders, presidents, generals, overseers, business moguls. All women experience those events, but not always in the same way. Then there are events on a pink timeline: access to education, employment, birth control, pampers, refrigeration, sewing machines, the right to vote, can sometimes be more significant in the lives of women than the traditional items. Finally, all women includes all women, women of different classes, races, religions, educational backgrounds, marital status, maternal status, gender orientation, geography, and age. Before historians draw a conclusion about women, they should ask which women. Fortunately, increasingly, they do. So the blue and pink and brown and black and rainbow narrative lines can weave together to create a more complex, more colorful, and more accurate patchwork of American history.
That, of course, is our guest today, author, historian Elizabeth Betsy Griffith. Betsy Griffith will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program presenting She Persisted and Resisted, Four Centuries of Women in America, which is an ongoing series. Please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via internet phone, Betsy Griffith. Betsy Griffith, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know, you are going to be appearing at the Smithsonian coming up. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But your series, your four-part series, is already underway. I wonder if you'd tell us briefly about both what you've done already and then maybe just briefly what's coming.
Well, I'm attempting a survey of four centuries of history in four sessions. Too many Americans know too little about the roles of American women, and the roles they've played are part in the development and the expansion of our democracy. And I want to offer not only some facts and some dates, but some broader concepts and some themes, and provoke people to learn even more. Every class comes with a reading list so people can dig more deeply, but I find women's history engaging and energizing and sometimes enraging, but it's always interesting. And most of us never had a class in women's history at any level of school, so there's a lot to learn. I've been teaching at college and high school and in public places since the 1970s, and I'm still learning. There's a lot to learn about women in history.
It is very interesting. I have never had a class in women's history. So I'm fascinated by this.
Well, and men and women take my class, so you are welcome anytime.
Good. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But it's very nice to talk to you right now. And I have a couple of questions about this, about women's history, because you say, one of the questions, as a matter of fact, that you ask and then answer is, how have we defined the appropriate roles for women and for which women? And then you say ladies, mill girls, slaves, or frontierswomen. So I wonder if you'd give us that answer a little bit about definition and tell us what you mean by frontierswomen.
Paul, you have really reached a significant question about women in history, because the roles they have been allowed to play have on the whole been defined by men. And I'm going to take you back even farther than American history, this whole idea of how women should behave, what they should be allowed to do, is in most cultures based in the creation myth. So in Judeo-Christian traditions, dating back to Genesis, women are Adam's rib. That was one version. There's the other version where men and women are created at the exact same moment in the image of God, but that raised so many questions that they stuck with Adam's rib. But that meant women were secondary and submissive. And that got carried over into religious law and then into common law practice and then into statutory law. So women, for most of written history, most of American history, have been legally subordinate to men, physically weaker than men, and so their roles have been viewed as less than. But there's another element here about not only the sort of attitudes toward women, but that those attitudes are then taught and reinforced. It's like that Rodgers and Hammerstein lyric, though you have to be carefully taught. We have all been taught our roles and our biases. And so, for example, what people wear. In colonial America, little boys wore dresses until they were 6 years old. And if you looked at a picture of a colonial child, you would have a hard time telling whether we're a boy or a girl. And then for many years, for years and years and years, women were not allowed to wear trousers and were confined in layers of clothes, yardage of clothes, in ways that were even unsafe. The introduction of the streetcar and the railroad proved how dangerous it was for women to carry a package, a child, and try to mount into one of those moving carriages. And that eventually led to shorter hemlines. Other things did as well. But this idea that it's not appropriate for women to be educated, it's not appropriate for women to work outside the home, it's not appropriate for women to vote or engage in political reform, those are sort of imposed views, which clearly don't make any sense factually, but it's how some people were raised. Now, going back to, I'm so glad you picked up on the different kinds of women, because then you have to ask, so does this apply to everybody? Women on the American frontier had more opportunities than women in other roles in our society because the frontier was so rigorous that men needed a partner, really an economic partner, to help turn raw materials into marketable products. It's one of the reasons that women get university education in the West earlier than in the East, that they vote in the West, that there was a value placed on the contributions of women to a community. Slave women are in horrible situations, have no rights once they're freed, either before or after slavery, depending on where they were living. Their opportunities would relate to their social status, their education, their skill sets. But then, another element of this is about the middle of the 19th century, when we began to have industrialization in this country, that changed this farm agrarian model that continued in the frontier. But on the East, there was less agrarianism, and people began to work in factories, which separated men from women, and it changed, again, the expectations. It created a class system, and it created ladies. And ladies who were not supposed to work. Ladies were supposed to consume. There was something called the cult of true womanhood, and true women were pious, pure, domestic, and submissive. That makes you wonder what men were. But in that role, they were in charge of the family and the children and faith. And but women who'd had maybe a little exposure or experience or education took advantage of that and said, well, if we're in charge of those things, we're also in charge of reform and improving society, and let's see what we can do. And that led to women's involvement in all kinds of activities.
Betsy Griffith, in your upcoming June 6th Smithsonian Associates program titled Reforming Women, you're to discuss... So let's go there. Let's talk about this idealized true woman who then evolves into the new woman and these interesting things that you cite as coming about during this shift, this era of higher hemlines, as you suggest, the shorter hair, the great migrations, the widening sexual freedom and voting rights. Tell us a little bit about what those meant for women at that time in history.
I will, but I want to backtrack a moment to reform because, again, challenging myself not to make generalizations about women. The on the majority of women who were ladies were going to be white, middle-class women, North, South, Midwest, and as the frontier moves west in the West. But these same characteristics would have applied to African-American women in post-Civil War America, who were under much more dangerous conditions and they had fewer resources. But African-American families put an even greater emphasis on education for women. By percentage, more black women, more black daughters were sent to college than white daughters, because African-American families saw it as a way to save their daughters from Jim Crow rape and harassment. So there are trailblazers among these same kind of, as white women turn to reform, abolition, temperance, anti-prostitution, women's rights, African-American women turn to anti-lynching. And so there are significant things happening in both the black and white community. Now, the question was about true women and new women.
Yes.
So true women goes back to this cult of true womanhood, these ladylike women who are supposedly confined in these domestic roles, these pious domestic roles. But as I say, that allowed them, some of them, to branch into reform activities. And those are the women who would bring us suffrage, temperance reform, abolition. The new woman applies to women at the beginning of the 20th century, and I think it's probably most typified by either the Gibson girl or the flapper. These were women who were more physically active, and not sure which came first, the shorter skirts or being able to breathe and move, or wanting to breathe and move, and so they shortened their skirts. These were women who had more opportunities for paid employment. But you were right to identify that sort of the metaphor of shorter skirts, shorter hair, is a sign of liberation. And just being able to, employment is also, like education, a move toward liberation. Employment especially, because if it took you out of your home or out of your neighborhood, it means you were less observed, less chaperoned, and could have more sex. You could have different courting rituals. You could neck more with the boy in 1910 than you ever could have in 1810, because everybody in your neighborhood, in your little small town, would have seen that happening and would have disapproved. So there are many changes in social behavior, in the definition of what's appropriate for women during this period, maybe from 1870 to 1920, quite dramatic changes. And these women, I want to go back and emphasize, many of them are working on very serious issues, the anti-lynching, the lynching in the South pushes the great migration of many African Americans into northern cities, and voting will be an enormous change once women achieve it. They achieve it at the state level in the 20 years before they get it at the federal level, and that leads to greater engagement. So these new women have new opportunities. And then for both black and white women, it all comes to a crash with the Great Crash and the Depression.
We are with Betsy Griffith. Betsy Griffith is going to be leading a 4-session evening lecture series titled She Persisted and Resisted, 4 Centuries of Women in America. As I say, the series is already underway as we're speaking. We talked for just a moment about the June 6th program. The final program in the series is scheduled for July 18th, and that's about Eleanor, Rosie, Rosa, and Betty. Who are they in the women's rights movement?
I imagine everybody will know these women, the women who are known by their first names.
Yes.
Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosie the Riveter, Rosa Parks, Betty Friedan. Of course, Rosie the Riveter represents the hundreds of thousands of American women who went into the war work during the Second World War. And they each represent a different decade of women's history, different fields of endeavor. Mrs. Roosevelt in politics. Rosie represents women workers. Rosa Parks, of course, civil rights. And Betty Friedan, women's rights. So Eleanor, everybody knows, is but relating to your just last question, she's really an example of the transition from a true woman to a new woman, because she was the dutiful wife and the mother of lots of children who evolved to be a political force of her own, taking on issues of labor and immigration and civil rights during her husband's administration and long afterwards. Rosie's important in so many ways, but two I want to mention in particular. One is that when these women went into the factories to be welders or to make parachutes or to rivet warships together, they, black and white women, were working in similar jobs, and you were paid for the job. So that if you were a riveter, you got the riveter wage as opposed to the women riveters' wage. Because riveting had previously been a male job. Some few men were still doing it, so they were all paid the same. It's one of the few examples of equal pay in American history, because they were able to do equal work. Now, if they were stitching parachutes, a, quote, woman's job, they got paid less. The other important thing about the Rosies is they reluctantly, maybe that's not entirely fair, people were very eager for the war to be over and to go home and have babies with the returning veterans. But a lot of women were sorry to give up the job because it gave them a paycheck and economic power and a sense of self-worth and a skill set. And so in American history, the number of women in the workforce has not decreased since 1945. It is an upward arrow from 1945 into the present. And women working changes every household in which a woman is bringing home a paycheck. It doesn't even have to be a big paycheck, but it changes the family dynamic. She might get to vote on what the new car is. She may be making more than her husband and together they're able to take different kinds of trips or have different opportunities for their children. But women in the workforce has created enormous change in American life. We still don't have equal pay across the board, and we don't have adequate child care, as we didn't have adequate child care in World War II. Rosa Parks is the name best known to white audiences about black civil rights activists, but there are so many more. Frankly, if it hadn't been for black women in the civil rights movement from the time of the anti-lynching, Ida Wells Barnett, Mary Church Terrell at the turn of the 20th century, at the end of Rosa Parks' the Montgomery bus boycott, Martin Luther King would have been very happy to go back to being a parish minister, but it was the church ladies in his congregation who said, wait, you can't quit. What, quit? No, you've got to keep going. And it was women like Ella Baker, who became the executive secretary of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or Daisy Bates, who chaperoned those Little Rock Nine to and from school every day for the entire school year. Diane Nash, who, when the Freedom Riders were bombed in Anniston, Alabama, she got a bunch of kids from Fisk in Nashville, including John Lewis and our former mayor of D.C., and got on a bus and continued the Freedom Rides despite the terror of it. And Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Party, and Constance Motley, who is the second attorney on the Brown case and the woman who argues for James Meredith to get in the University of Mississippi, and then is the first African-American judge named ever by Lyndon Johnson. But there are all these. So Rosa represents, she's the name we recognize, but a wider audience would recognize all those other names. So it's important to acknowledge the work those women did. And similarly, Betty Friedan, known for publishing The Feminine Mystique in 1963, some people think, quote, the second women's movement started then, but you could also argue that the first one never ended, we're just in different stages. Mm-hmm. But again, you have Martha Griffiths, who got us Title VII, Shirley Chisholm, you have Dolores Huerta and the farm workers, Wilma Mankiller and the Native American rights. And then you have people whose names we're never going to know, the women who were members of the Red Stockings or the Janes, who were all sort of really militant, local-level women. I think the Boston Women's Collective may be one that's the best known because they published that book, Our Bodies, Ourselves. So many layers to the 1960s women's activism. And if I had a fifth and sixth class, we could go on and talk about Sally Ride and Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg. Because it gets to be, you have to be careful in women's history not to focus just on the firsts or the names, but to think about what they represent and how these changes, I mean, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 was really intended, obviously, to be a civil rights act, but by inserting the word sex into that particular clause, it opened up enormous employment opportunities. And without an Equal Rights Amendment, that Title VII has given the Supreme Court the legislative base on which to make some of the decisions which have helped advance women's lives. So you can see how excited I get about women's history.
Oh, it is.
And how much there is to learn.
Yeah, there is a lot to learn. It is a very interesting, important subject. And you refer to this just a moment ago when you say the women's movement isn't done. It's not always so wise to focus on those early women and perhaps ignoring some of what's going on today. And certainly with respect to the title, She Persisted and Resisted, are, in your opinion, women still persisting and resisting? And we have of course, the movement now, the hashtag MeToo movement. Is that persistence? Is that resistance? Is that both going on? Are we making progress? Are men responsible for this? Are women not listening to women? Where are we today with all of this, Betsy Griffith?
There would be no progress for women's rights in our country without male allies. Mm. Only one woman had the opportunity to vote for the suffrage amendment, Jeanette Rankin, who was the only woman who served in Congress during that period, because she came from a state that allowed women to vote, a Republican from Montana. So we have always relied on male allies, and we always will. I think that the persistence, resistance, those are attitudes and activities that women need to engage in. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's helpful to me as a historian is to remember how long it takes to change anything. Sometimes it seems speedier than others, but it took 72 years from 1848 to 1920 for us to get the vote, and still not everybody was included until you had the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 or the amendment to get rid of the poll tax. And we still worry about whether everybody has access to the polls. Mm-hmm. I think there's been enormous positive change in the lives of women. When I was teaching high school, I would ask one of my final exam questions was, which was more important, women getting suffrage in 1920, the passage of Title IX, which was the Sports Education Equality Act, whether it's the creation of the birth control pill so women had more opportunity to control their reproductive systems. You know, how do you say what's making the greatest difference for women? Mm-hmm. Clearly, we have many more women being educated, many more women employed, and I think those two things then lead to the activism that allows women to use their vote. But we're still addressing sexual violence and harassment, issues of pay inequity, the need for child care, and as we've seen expressed just this week in the news, patriarchal attitudes sometimes abound. But I think if you think of it in the course of American history as an expansion of democracy, that we just need to keep making sure that everybody's included and not assume, because maybe we personally have advanced, that means everybody has advanced. I've been so pleased that the Me Too movement has said this isn't just about movie stars or journalists, but it's about housekeepers in hotels and restaurant workers, people who don't have quite the power to be able to protect themselves in the ways that they would like. But I do think that having some women's history in your background is sort of like putting on armor, that you have the shield and sword of sisterhood to march forward and say, we can do this because we've done it before. And we have to persist and we have to resist.
Betsy Griffith, What an interesting, important subject for women and for men. Thank you so much for joining us today. I could definitely talk to you for a long time. We're going to put links up to where we can find you, where we can find more information about the Smithsonian Associates program. But thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciated the opportunity. Thank you.
Absolutely. My thanks to our guest today, Betsy Griffith, who will be at the Smithsonian Associates program presenting She Persisted and Resisted, Four Centuries of Women in America, which is an ongoing series. Check out our website for more information about the Smithsonian Associates program featuring Betsy Griffith. My thanks as well to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support our interviews. As usual, we'll post links to everything, and also as usual, my thanks to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Your time is valuable, and I'm grateful you're spending some of it with me. I am always interested in feedback, and you can leave that at iTunes, Google Play, or send me email at info@notold-better.com. Stay tuned for our next show, another great one, as we talk about better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks, everybody, and please remember to check out genealogybank.com/NOBS for great genealogy newspaper articles, history, and data, and support the show. That's genealogybank.com/NOBS. Thank you.